This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to the program. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's AM, the pandemic produces a massive spike in customer complaints about travel companies. And why is it so hard to deliver decent housing to remote Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory?
We had these houses that, to be honest, that look kind of like a cage.
What we've seen to date has been a dismal failure. We can't keep accepting that people live in overcrowded, impoverished situations.
The US President-elect Joe Biden's declared America is back after introducing his senior team of security and foreign affairs officials. He's now formally begun the transition to the White House after the Trump administration finally ended its obstruction of the process. But as North America correspondent David Lipson reports, Donald Trump is still refusing to concede.
A hastily convened press conference in the West Wing briefing room.
Well, thank you very much.
President Donald Trump lauded another record high on the Dow Jones.
The stock market's just broken 30,000. That's a sacred number, 30,000. Nobody thought they'd ever see it.
He said he was thrilled with the progress made on coronavirus vaccines. And then...
I just want to congratulate all the people within the administration that worked so hard. And most importantly, I want to congratulate the people of our country because there are no people like you. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
Ignoring the shouted questions about whether and when he'll concede, Donald Trump walked out the door 65 seconds after walking in. In Wilmington, Delaware, President-elect Joe Biden took to the stage to introduce his first cabinet picks.
America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it. Once again, sit at the head of the table. Ready to confront our adversaries and not reject our allies. Ready to stand up for our values.
Antony Blinken will be Secretary of State. John Kerry, who served in that role under Barack Obama, is now a special envoy for climate change, and he's urging the world to come together again to meet the challenge.
Paris alone is not enough. At the global meeting in Glasgow 1 year from now, all nations must raise ambition together, or we will all fail together. And failure is not an option.
Alejandro Mayorkas will be the first immigrant to serve as Secretary of Homeland Security. Avril Haines is the first female Director of National Intelligence. And Linda Thomas-Greenfield, an African-American veteran of the Foreign Service, will be ambassador to the UN.
I want to say to you, America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back.
It's a familiar team known to diplomats around the world. Many worked closely together under Barack Obama. It's clear they're determined to redo everything Donald Trump undid. Joe Biden says he's pleased the formal transition process has begun after being blocked for 2 weeks by the Trump administration. And he's hoping the Republican-controlled Senate, which must confirm most of his cabinet picks, won't use the same tactics.
To the United States Senate, I hope these outstanding nominees received a prompt hearing and that we can work across the aisle in good faith to move forward for the country. Let's begin that work to heal and unite. To heal and unite America as well as the world.
Joe Biden's already setting up meetings with government officials, and the Biden team's website address now ends with the letters .gov. This is David Lipson in Washington for AM.
Vaccine announcements are coming in thick and fast, with Russia, the latest country to declare trials of its vaccine, are going well. Authorities there say the latest stage 3 data suggests the Russian vaccine is 91% effective. Moscow says more than a billion doses of the vaccine will be produced and made available for about $20 for 2 doses. Barbara Miller reports.
Russia's not hiding its raw ambitions in the vaccine game. It's named its product Sputnik V after the satellite the Soviets successfully launched in the late 1950s, triggering the space race. Sputnik V has its own Twitter account, and overnight it issued some breaking news, claiming a second interim analysis of late-stage trial data showed the vaccine was 91% effective. Sputnik V belongs to the same category of vaccines as the Oxford AstraZeneca product being developed in the UK. Professor Peter Openshaw from Imperial College London.
The Oxford vaccine is a much lower dose than the Sputnik V vaccine and has a much safer side effect profile. The Russians have gone for a really big slug of virus, which causes quite significant short-term side effects, which are probably acceptable under the circumstances. So it's the same sort of technology, but there are big, important differences.
Full data from all the vaccines has yet to be peer-reviewed, but Kylie Quinn from RMIT University says from what we do know about the Russian trials, there is cause for a little more scepticism.
This new data from Russia, it's been indicated on their website that they analysed 39 cases of people who've gotten COVID-19 with either the vaccine or the placebo in their clinical trial. And so that's a relatively low number of individuals to perform this kind of analysis with. So to give you some context, the Pfizer vaccines, Moderna and the AstraZeneca were all sort of closer to 100 or over in terms of the number of patients they analysed. And the Pfizer vaccine, they had indicated that they were initially just going to analyse 32 patients, and they revised that up to 94 on advice from the research community and from the US FDA.
How then should we feel about this Russian announcement?
So I think it's early days. It's promising. It will be interesting to follow, and hopefully that efficacy level holds. But it is still at an earlier point than the other vaccines.
Russia has also announced competitive pricing for Sputnik V, which it says will cost around $20 for two doses, though it says Russians will receive it for free. And there will be significant demand. More than 2 million Russians have contracted coronavirus so far, and close to 37,000 have died of it. That's out of 60 million cases worldwide and 1.4 million deaths.
Barbara Miller reporting. More coronavirus restrictions are being eased. In New South Wales, more people will soon be allowed into pubs and cafes, and workers will be encouraged to head back into the office. Victoria's hoping that Queensland will reopen its border to residents soon. Premier Daniel Andrews says at midnight last night there were no new cases in Victoria.
Look, I was texting Anastasia Palaszczuk throughout the day yesterday. We're confident that we'll get those borders open.
Meanwhile, the news was barely out yesterday that Queensland will reopen to Sydneysiders on Tuesday, and accommodation prices started to soar. Travel agents say Queensland tourist hotspots are booking out over Christmas, and prices have increased by up to 300%. Annie Guest reports from Brisbane.
So I'm just going to put you on hold, 90 seconds. So I can just take that payment now.
These Gold Coast-based travel agents are busy for the first time in months.
Just know that when I put you through...
They work for the Ignite Travel Group. Ryan Thomas is the chief executive.
After the announcement, our phones have gone off the hook, and we've had our record day since January this year. And so, yeah, the atmosphere is electric.
He says most want bookings on the Gold and Sunshine Coasts.
It's ranging anywhere between $400 to well over $1,200 a night, depending on your quality of accommodation.
And those same places, if it wasn't so busy?
Yeah normally between your $150 to $400, just because they've got no inventory left, and they're actually making money for the first time in a long time.
And the high prices in southeast Queensland are prompting more bookings in the state's far north, despite the onset of the cyclone and stinger season. But while Queensland is lifting its remaining travel restrictions on New South Wales, the border checkpoints won't be coming down anytime soon. Permits and police checks will continue to stop any travellers from remaining hotspots like South Australia, restrictions that remain an irritation for some border residents.
It has come at quite a cost to the locals, and it does seem like the border has been more of an issue locally than the virus has.
This GP on the Queensland-New South Wales border, who doesn't want to be named, says residents must update their permits fortnightly online, which is impossible for some elderly residents.
We did have an elderly lady who was being driven home by her daughter because she'd been in hospital. She didn't have a pass. She was stopped at the border and required to get a pass on the daughter's mobile phone, but then go and rejoin the queue. So even though she was still ill, still recovering from her illness, trying to get home to rest at home, she had to wait an hour in the road queue. And that's the story that we're getting still.
Have you done this order for the chips and gravy?
Yeah.
Gone through.
Steve Simon owns a seafood shop in Tweed Heads, 850 metres south of the Queensland border.
Most of our customers are coming from Queensland and no, obviously no Queensland customers are coming over, mainly because they don't want to go back in the traffic because of the border passes.
He says reopening the border to Sydneysiders is a positive step, but he's uncertain how to plan.
Now that we've got a definite or hopefully a definitive opening date, we might start putting on more staff for Christmas.
Tweedhead's business owner Steve Simon ending Annie Guest's report. The Consumer Watchdog says there's been a huge spike in complaints against travel companies during the pandemic. So far this year, the ACCC has received more than 24,000 complaints about cancellation policies and some about travel businesses misleading consumers about their right to a refund. There's been plenty of confusion too, with many customers shocked to discover because of the pandemic they weren't automatically entitled to get their money back. Our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan has been looking at the complaints.
Well, good morning, Sabra. The problem is that when cancellations occur because of government restrictions, as we saw earlier this year, and a business is restricted from fulfilling its obligations, consumers aren't automatically entitled to a refund as they normally would under Australian consumer law. So when government restrictions such as closed borders, grounded airlines and holiday plans from travel agents were thrown into chaos, that in many cases was the out for some travel companies. So having been knocked back for refunds, travellers flocked to the ACCC, resulting in 24,000 complaints, up a massive 497% on the same period last year. There were so many complaints that the ACCC set up a special task force to try to negotiate through the myriad of terms and conditions, and found that in some cases, businesses stuck to the fine print rather than doing the right thing and misled consumers about their rights. Earlier this year, the ACCC confirmed it was dealing with Qantas, Etihad and Flight Centre to broker solutions. There was also a lot of confusion when Virgin Australia collapsed into administration. But it wasn't just travel. There were also complaints about bad behaviour by gymnasiums forced to close during the pandemic and petrol retailers cashing in by gouging prices. But ACCC Commissioner Sarah Court says that while some businesses helped with hardship policies, others, particularly those in travel, played very hard by the rules.
We did unfortunately see examples where consumers were told, no, sorry, you're not entitled to a refund under the terms and conditions, when in fact they were entitled to a refund in this circumstance. We saw some examples of businesses retrospectively changing the terms and conditions and saying, oh, look, because of COVID, the terms and conditions don't apply, you can't get a refund, when that was not the case. So in those few situations, we did engage reasonably strenuously with those businesses. We said we did not think the terms and conditions enabled them to do that.
And what happens with those companies? Are you taking them to court or are they fined?
No, we've made a deliberate decision here not to take companies to court because the legal process can be a lengthy and uncertain process. We decided that we would engage with those companies, encourage them to do the right thing. And in those circumstances, we were able to achieve a resolution. Didn't involve a fine, but it involved the consumers getting their money back. I should add there, though, there remain a few issues that we are continuing to look at. And if we are unable to resolve some of those, we may well go down that more traditional enforcement route in due course.
And in addition to resolving complaints from consumers, there's also been a lot of scams during COVID-19. What have the big ones been?
Every time we see government distributing money, as has been the case during COVID, unfortunately, the scammers tend to emerge. So we've seen things like identity theft, phishing scams, effectively people trying to access those monetary benefits from the government to particular individuals.
That's the ACCC Commissioner Sarah Court, and she was speaking with Peter Ryan. Would you be willing to hand over information about your ethnicity if it would help authorities deal with the COVID-19 pandemic? That could be a reality soon, with the federal government confirming it's considering recording cultural background and languages spoken when someone gets a COVID-19 test. With more, here's political reporter Stephanie Dalzell.
When you get a COVID-19 test, you also give your name, contact, age and address. It's personal information that's crucial to the government's pandemic response because it tells them how many active cases there are, where they are, and the number of people being tested. But for some experts, a vital piece of the puzzle has been missing.
We don't have this data, so we're running on empty, really.
That missing information, according to Professor Andrew Yakubovich from the University of Technology, Sydney, is a person's ethnic background. The Health Department has confirmed it's actively considering recording a person's cultural and linguistic diversity when they get a COVID-19 test, with the states, territories and even private laboratories to agree to national guidelines to collect that information. And Professor Yakubovich says having that data will allow authorities to adjust and improve contact tracing strategies.
It's important to know if particular groups are being affected badly. It's important to know if some groups are being missed out in the testing regime. It's important to know what sort of networks exist in local areas and how that might help trackers get to the source of any infection that might be happening. It also helps us know which groups are the most vulnerable because they haven't been caught up in the testing regimes.
The first outbreaks of the second wave in Melbourne's outer suburbs were among culturally diverse communities. And diversity consultant Tasneem Chopra believes having information about ethnicity also alerts governments if their messages aren't getting through.
If the data is actually indicating that there's one particular community group more so than others that's presenting itself as testing positive, I think this is an opportunity for systems and for health service providers to be more creative in the ways they're engaging.
The federal government has come under criticism for its handling of multicultural communities during the pandemic. Departments have used Google Translate to communicate crucial messages, while community leaders have complained of being involved in the pandemic response on an ad hoc basis or not at all. The ABC has now learned the government is setting up a task force to help it engage with multicultural groups. And for Tasneem Chopra, it's a welcome move.
Research has shown specifically in the last few months that even community leaders within a lot of our called communities don't lack the capacity to engage with their flock, with their membership. It's simply maybe the resource capacity. So provide more media campaigns, provide them with the resources, with training perhaps. The uptick is there, the desire is there. Everybody wants to get this to zero permanently.
Diversity consultant Tasneem Chopra ending Stephanie Dalzell's report. For decades, Aboriginal communities have been outraged, hearing promises of hundreds of millions of dollars from both the Commonwealth and Northern Territory governments for new housing, and then a glacial pace, resulting in not much. The federal government's been talking tough in the past 24 hours, threatening to strip the Gunner administration of responsibility for delivering housing, but it's since walked back that threat. Jane Barden reports.
Remote Aboriginal residents, including Jabiru traditional owner Corbin Majandi, were among those who came to Darwin last night to hear the federal government's plan to fix the slow rollout of Indigenous housing.
We had these houses that, to be honest, that looked kind of like a cage.
The federal Indigenous Australians Minister Ken Wyatt came to the NT on the warpath, threatening to transfer responsibility for delivering $500 million of remote housing from the Gunner government to Aboriginal land councils.
I just find it heartbreaking to see three elders living in a tin shed in a first world country.
The Commonwealth says after 18 months, just four of 650 houses it funded have been built by the NT government. The NT Chief Minister Michael Gunner.
We deliberately have a remote housing program that will scale up. We want to do that to maximise local employment.
By last night's speech, Ken Wyatt had pulled back somewhat from his threat.
In discussions today, there is a strong commitment to accelerate.
But he said he's still considering the proposal from the NT's four land councils to at least take some control.
Certainly, if we have to escalate activity by looking at different options, that's what we're doing. I've had a meeting with the Gunner government and we had a discussion around housing, and they will now escalate activity around the housing.
They've been saying the same thing on that for 12 years. Do you have more confidence now?
Yes, I do.
The Gunner government used as the excuse it was going slowly because they were trying to train local Indigenous people. They said that the last time they were in government as well. How credible is that?
Well, look, I don't know the reasons for the slowness.
Marion Scrimger is the Northern Land Council CEO.
What we've seen to date has been a dismal failure. We keep making the excuses and we're seeing excuse after excuse.
Are you disappointed that Ken Wyatt seems to have been mollified somewhat and he's softened his line?
I can understand that he needs to work with and get the Chief Minister and the Northern Territory Government to meet their responsibility. If it means softening the stance a little bit, I think that that's important.
You know that trying to deliver this housing's always problematic. Do you think the Land Councils would be able to do it better than government?
Look, we're not saying we'll do it any better. I think we've got to give it a try, Jane. We can't keep accepting that people live in overcrowded, impoverished situation. And we will work with federal government, Northern Territory government to make sure that this rolls out.
That's the Northern Land Council's Marion Scrimger, and she was speaking there with our reporter Jane Barden. They fought fires, protected property, and in many cases had to flee their own homes. But for the communities hit by the devastating summer bushfires, the effects of smoke inhalation could emerge as one of the most damaging long-term problems. A new report by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare has found regions affected by bushfires saw significant increases in presentations to emergency departments for respiratory problems and a jump in sales of asthma medication. What's less visible are the long-term implications of exposure to bushfire smoke, something one of Australia's leading respiratory experts is now investigating, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
This time last year, Dr. Peter Gibson remembers the sense of foreboding as bushfires tore through the New South Wales Hunter region.
I remember the very substantial changes in the environment, dark skies, the soot and the burnt material at the beach. Just floating on the water. And I remember a lot of concern expressed to me by people with lung problems.
As a respiratory specialist at John Hunter Hospital in Newcastle, he's seen the effects of smoke exposure before in previous bushfires.
So I'd been aware of the implications of short-term bushfire smoke exposure, but wasn't really prepared or in my thinking or practice for prolonged exposure.
An Australian Institute of Health and Welfare report into the short-term health impacts of last summer's bushfire season found dramatic increases in the number of people presenting to New South Wales hospital emergency departments with respiratory problems. There was a 50% increase in respiratory presentations to hospitals in Batemans Bay on the state's south coast from late December, and an 86% increase in the Riverina region in early January. The long-term effect of the fires is not yet known, but Dr. Gibson has already started his research into people with existing asthma, which he says will reveal how smoke exposure affects the rest of the population.
We're looking at two vulnerable groups of people, those with severe asthma and pregnant women with asthma. Because this was a season like no other, these people are highly affected and can tell us what are the impacts and how that might then roll on to the rest of the population.
But there are some hints as to what the effect might be.
Some of the things that we will probably see is that your lungs, in theory, will probably age a bit faster.
Professor Bruce Thompson, a respiratory health expert at Swinburne University, says the results of a study into the 2014 Hazelwood mine fire in Victoria shows what smoke exposure does to the lungs.
And some of the things we found in children, like young children, the lungs became slightly stiffer. And that's a bit of a problem because at the end of the day, the lungs have to be able to be quite flexible when you breathe in and out. And if it starts becoming stiffer, it's almost like it's aged a bit. And that's not quite what you want to do when you've got something that's actually growing. And that sort of effect seems to have actually happened in also adults as well, where we're sort of getting what we call is just like a little bit of narrowing in the airways, and it's increasing the sort of resistance of them, and also the lungs are becoming a bit stiffer again as well.
Dr. Peter Gibson's study is funded by the federal government, and he expects preliminary results to be published next year.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. That is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.